Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to your leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman. In this episode, Neurology Live editor Marco Meglio is joined by Dr. Jennifer Frontera, a professor of neurology at NYU Langone Grossman School of Medicine and a neurocritical care specialist who shares her experience in working on the front line during the COVID-19 pandemic in providing care for patients with the virus who have pre-existing neurologic conditions. She details her firsthand experience with COVID-19 in a hospital setting, as well as what neurologic symptoms have been observed in these patients.
I'm primarily a neurologist and neurointensivist, but you know, given the volume of patients in the surge in New York City, anyone with any critical care background has been pulled to take care of the COVID patients. So I alternate my time between taking care of COVID patients at night and during the day, and then taking care of neuro or surgically critically ill patients. So what I can say is the COVID patients are extremely sick. This is ARDS to the exponential level. They're much sicker than the patients we typically care for. And, in terms of what we're seeing neurologically, it's a spectrum. And I think we're probably underestimating what's happening neurologically with these patients because they're all sedated, oftentimes paralyzed. We don't have a neurological exam on them. There's not enough imaging really being done on these patients for many reasons. One, they're hard to transport because they're medically unstable. And then, second, it's a resource situation where, everyone is doing, extra work and stretched to the extent that they can. There's often not necessarily clinical suspicion because we can't examine these patients. And so right now we're finding, just as we're starting to try to wake people up to try to wean them off the ventilator, that some of these patients aren't waking up and that they have actually profound hypoxic injury. Even if they didn't have a cardiac arrest, we're seeing imaging that looks like patients with cardiac arrest. That's how profound the hypoxic anoxic brain injury is in some of these folks. We've seen other spectrums of neurological issues, anywhere from just straightforward encephalopathy, which is very common, right? Because you have patients without sleep-wake cycles, on various sedations and drugs, and so they're going to be either have delirium or some version of encephalopathy. A lot of them are uremic because the coincidence of renal failure is so high in these patients because of the probably the ACE2 receptor expression in the kidneys is so high. Then we're also seeing things that could be directly related to the virus in the CNS or peripheral nervous system, and then also post-infectious complications. So for direct viral complications, now no one's been able to isolate SARS-CoV-2 in the CSF. I think there was one report of this being done, but it's unclear if there was some cross-contamination or if that was truly positive in the CSF. Issues may be that the assays that we're currently using for the serum are not sensitive for that kind of biospecimen, or that there, frankly, is not actually virus in the passing the blood-brain barrier. We don't know that yet. There are ACE2 receptors are displayed on glial cells, oligodendrocytes, neurons, but it's not clear that they're displayed in enough density that there is true neuroinvasion. Now, one thing that we've thought for a while is that a lot of these patients have a lack of smell, lack of taste. Mm-hmm. It would make sense that the virus could potentially be traveling retrograde, like up through the cribriform plate, then retrograde along the olfactory bulbs into the skull base. But again, this is just conjecture at this point. We don't really have good pathologic data to back that up yet. Other things that we were seeing early on was a lot of these patients were syncopizing. They had lack of dyspnea. It was disproportionately non-dyspneic compared to their level of hypoxia. So patients would be sitting around, like sometimes people call it happy hypoxia, where they're feeling fine, but their oxygen levels are super low. And normally patients would be more dyspneic in those circumstances. And so people also conjectured that maybe there is reticular activating system brainstem level involvement that's suppressing some of these respiratory drive reflexes. Same thing for the syncope, that maybe that's reticular activating system mediated, because it's not common to syncopize in the context of pneumonia, for example. So that's a curious finding. And then we are also seeing what looked like potentially sympathetic storming or dysautonomia or cytokine storming, where, you know, not only would people have fluctuations in blood pressure, heart rate, but diaphoresis, hyperthermia, but also sometimes these abnormal movements that look like posturing that we see in like traumatic brain injury patients that are dysautonomic or have sympathetic storming. We were seeing that in some of these COVID-19 patients. And initially, you know, they do look seizure-like, so but we've had some patients who we've captured the movements and there's no EEG correlate, right? But they're very dysautonomic, so it makes us believe perhaps there's a storming component here. We're still at the point of collecting data to try to back up these hypotheses. So this, right now, these are observations. I wouldn't say that we've proven anything yet, other than, you know, we have observed seizures also in these patients. That can occur. People have described encephalitis in these patients. We've had patients with Guillain-Barré coming through, which of course is a post-infectious manifestation in most cases. We may see another spike in Guillain-Barré because it usually occurs, as you know, like within, you know, weeks to a couple of months after the initial infection. So that may still be coming. We're still like in the midst of this kind of surge, at least in New York City. So I think a lot of data is rolling in every day. It's, you know, we get more information and so it seems to be changing by the moment. Strokes also, and we get to this point where we don't know how much is casual versus causal, right? Because strokes happen at a high frequency in the population anyway. If the seroprevalence is as high as we believe it is, so like these prevalence studies in New York that they just reported yesterday being like 21% prevalence, seroprevalence in New York City, you know, it's, you start to think like maybe they are not necessarily related. That being said, the hypercoagulable prothrombotic state associated with the cytokine inflammatory response in COVID certainly could predispose you to having cerebral thrombosis. So a lot to kind of parse through still. Luckily, we have a lot of data. Luckily or not luckily, I mean, it's unfortunate, certainly for New York City, but it is an opportunity to learn more about the virus as we have a lot of patients coming through.
Obviously, we talk all the time about how there's a certain portion of the population that's way more at risk than the rest. People who are compromised, people who smoke, people who are of older age, people who have neurologic disorders or conditions. Can you talk about the increased risk for patients with a neurologic disorder? And are there any populations of particular concern?
So, at this point, we're still looking through our data to see if people with underlying neuro issues are more predisposed than others. We have a group at NYU and we're interested in underlying cognitive issues and how that pertains to your risk of sequelae if you get COVID. So clearly, like, patients with dementia or cognitive problems tend to be older. Those folks also, age alone is a predictor of poor outcome in many different disease processes, including COVID. So we're going to need a lot more data to try to determine if it's the dementia itself or age-related processes that are causing people to do worse. But, you know, our speculation is that since encephalopathy and delirium is so common, that would be even more prevalent along with behavioral disturbances in an older population. So that if those patients do contract COVID, they may have more neurological complications or not do as well. Are they predisposed to contracting COVID just by the fact that they have dementia? Very hard to say. I would hesitate to say anything like that right now. By the fact that folks that are doing poorly from COVID and or have neurologic complications that are serious usually have respiratory manifestations that are relatively profound, and those seem to predominate in terms of dictating mortality or major functional outcomes. So I think that the things that predispose folks to having the pulmonary manifestations are probably going to drive risk more so than other factors. And I know at NYU they did look through risk factors for hospitalization, and they are, they're related to age, they're related to hypoxia, as you might imagine, and they're related to pro-inflammatory markers like CRP and D-dimer. I don't know that they looked at all kinds of neurologic baseline issues in terms of predicting who gets hospitalized, i.e. who is sicker with COVID. We're still, I think, trying to parse that out. So we have this global consortium that we've organized, and we have about 60 sites participating now. We've developed some common data elements to try to understand patients' baseline neurological issues, neurological complications they may develop in the context of a COVID infection, and then how are these folks doing long term. So that is a project that's ongoing, and I think what we'll need to do is we're going to need to really get prospective data on these people and look at how they do, not just in regards to in-hospital mortality or discharge disposition, but longer term outcomes, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, et cetera, functional and cognitive outcomes, and probably neuropsych outcomes as well, which is, in Italy, I was just listening to NPR on this, like that the psychological impact in Italy, where they've been sequestered for a longer period of time in quarantine, is profound, and they've had a very high death rate per capita. So that's going to be a whole other wave of issues, not just amongst COVID survivors, but amongst caregivers as well. So I think that's another story that's going to develop.
You mentioned the study, and you mentioned how we're continuing to build data right now, but we also want to see the data of when people recover, or just the after effect of all of this, for the long term. Can you talk about what preventative measures do you think these patients should be taking after the curve starts to even out, as we've started to see?
Yeah, I mean, for the moment, I would say they certainly need to take the precautions that the general population is taking in terms of quarantining, using masks, hand hygiene, and, distancing themselves, both social distancing and also distancing from any potentially infected relatives or people they might ordinarily come into contact with. I think that's the most important thing now, and of course to vaccinate as soon as a vaccine becomes available. That's absolutely critical, because you're correct in saying that patients with neurological baseline disorders are a relatively vulnerable population. They tend to have other comorbidities in addition to their neurological issues. Some of them are immunosuppressed by the very nature of their treatment regimen, and certainly need to take additional precautions if they are immunosuppressed beyond that of the average population.
I know you touched on it before. Has there been any published data that has stuck out to you or really kind of surprised you so far in just the early stages of us learning more about COVID-19?
So I think what has come out in terms of Chinese data or even the French data that was published in New England Journal, these are case series. A lot of them don't drill down as much as we might like on neurologic pathology. Like, so for example, Having a headache, I mean, is very common with viral syndromes. We're not necessarily consider that a neurological sequelae, although that's the most commonly reported finding in a lot of these case series. Certainly, we would like more data, more neuroimaging, more substantiation of certain diagnoses, and a larger series, plus really kind of a series looking at what's going on globally, because it may vary regionally, and we certainly know that there are different strains of this virus. And which may perhaps perform or differently. So the European versus the Asian strains may have different degrees of neuro proclivity to infect the nervous system. We don't know yet. So I think having the global project that we're working on is going to be pretty useful, because we'll be able to make some of those comparisons internationally to see what the effects are. We're also including a pediatric component as well. So, there's really a paucity of data amongst pediatric patients, thankfully, because it's so much less common to severely affect the pediatric population. But we do certainly need to understand more about what's going on in kids that have COVID. And there's probably, certain pediatric populations that are more susceptible or prone to having poorer outcomes than the general pediatric population.
Is there anything else that people should know about, or the general population should know about, that they don't really think about when it comes to just neurologic symptoms and COVID-19 and this whole discussion just in general?
One thing we do want to get out to the community is that one thing that's been observed in New York City, for example, is much lower rates of admissions for our common neuro diseases like stroke, seizure, intracranial hemorrhage or intracerebral hemorrhage. And, we speculate that some of those patients may be afraid to come to the hospital because they don't want to get infected if they come to the hospital, and yet they may need acute stroke treatment, for example. And so we really do want to encourage folks that, the organization in many of these hospitals is much better than it was at the beginning of this pandemic. And so, you really do need to come in and get treatment as fast as possible. We're certainly afraid that a lot of people are dying at home from strokes and from very common neurologic pathology that is imminently treatable. And so people should really come back to the hospital and think about time is brain and getting treatment as fast as possible, irrespective of your concerns about COVID infection. So we do want to kind of get the word out about that amongst patients taking care of critically ill or providers taking care of critically ill patients. We'd also like to remind folks to think about neurological sequelae, even of protracted hypoxia, and consider really evaluating these patients both neurologically in an exam context, but also perhaps with imaging, which will help in terms of prognostication, family discussions, and even potentially goals of care conversations. So for the non-neurological or general critical care providers, we just want to remind folks to keep in mind that neurological sequelae are happening, and in some cases only being diagnosed by surveillance imaging. Just something to think about.
Thanks for listening to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. For more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.